Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Tony from VSA Group in Drexel Hill.
Yeah, I'm a little taller than most. I'm a recovered alcoholic, and my name is Tony Shara. And I'm honored to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous and to come out to your group. And when I pulled up, I saw it was a Mennonite church, and I was kind of like, I've never been to a meeting in a Mennonite church. And that's kind of awesome. So when we read the preamble, my first sponsor always told me that my primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That's the only thing that I'm supposed to be doing. Everything else is like an add-on to that. And for me, I'm like, this is echoing a little bit and kind of throwing me off. But from a really young age, as long back as I could remember, I felt like everybody else had gotten together and had a meeting, and they'd handed out a handbook on how to be a friend and how to play together and how to do things, and I just didn't make that meeting. And it always seemed like I was the odd man out. I always felt like I was different. My dad died when I was really young. My mom was sick as long as I could remember. I always felt not part of. And I wanted to be anybody else, living in anybody else's family, dressed. I just didn't want to be me. And that's like my earliest memories. For me, the disease of alcoholism, it centers in my spirit and it centers in my mind, and it manifested in a lot of different ways, and I can see it manifesting in my life at 7 and 8 years old. Attention-seeking behavior, stealing because it got a rush off of it, telling people lies to see if they would tell other people, manipulation, if mom says no, ask grandmom, if grandmom says no, ask Uncle Mike, and work the family, and getting three versions of lunch money, and all that stuff. And I went through 13 schools in 12 years. I was considered a behavioral problem. Apparently, I didn't handle my father's death very well. I don't know at 6 years old how you're supposed to handle death. I really don't. I became violent, and I started to break things and hurt people because I hurt inside. And when I hurt inside, I want you to hurt too. You know, and that's just how I remember it. And pretty soon my mom couldn't take care of me anymore, and I ended up in foster care. I was in and out of group homes and foster homes, and I graduated from Milton Hershey School. I got in there right before my 16th birthday. One of my foster fathers was actually a really good foster family in Berwick. They had 9 of their own natural kids, and they just were used to having a lot of kids, and when their kids got older, they just started taking in more kids. And, you know, for a long time, I had this viewpoint on my childhood as this horrible thing that I survived, and it was like this trial by fire. And today, I understand that I was armed with a lot of different experiences to help a lot of different people. Every one of those foster families had a spiritual belief system. Every one of them went to church. I went to Seventh-day Adventist. I went to Episcopalian, Evangelical, Baptist. I was raised Catholic. I went to all these different churches, and I heard the generally same message. And it wasn't that there was this punishing God, that there was this loving God, that there was this Father, this thing that could take care of me. But I'm an intellectual person. I'm a few points shy of Mensa. I don't say that to brag because I destroyed most of it. I was in LD classes growing up. I'm dyslexic. I see things backwards, which is very apropos if you're alcoholic. And I couldn't read or write until I was in the fourth grade. I was on the short bus, literally on the short bus. And they IQ tested me, and then I spent 1 year in mainstream school, and then the next year I was in the accelerated program. And in sixth grade I was taking college-level courses. I learned some tricks about how to see things. I still do math differently, and I do a lot of things differently than most people. And I thought I was so different and so special. My first sponsor used to call it terminally unique and fatally cool. And none of that has anything to do with why I'm alcoholic. That's just kind of where I come from. I call it drama and trauma. It's really what it was. Right before my graduation, my mom went into a coma. And they rushed me back from school, and I spent a week beside her bed. And on the fifth day, she woke up, and she was lucid. And it was years since she had been able, like, I would come home and find her drooling on herself. I had to change her from 10 years old. She used to tell me, "You're the man of the house." And I had become the man of the house at 10 years old. But she was awake, and she was lucid. And we talked about all the things that, like, I remember from my childhood that were cool, like driving up to, like, see the leaves and drive around and see Christmas lights and big gulps after church and just, like, really cool stuff. And I got to tell her that I loved her, and it was okay. I was going to be okay. And 3 weeks later, she died. And 3 days after that was the first time I ever got loaded. That was the last thing I cared about on this planet was my mother. And right after she passed, I went to my mom's funeral, my senior prom, on the same day. And I thought that would make me different. There's a girl in South Philly group, not South Philly group, but South Philly area. I went to her dad's funeral and her junior prom on the same day. Everything that I thought made me different, I've heard somewhere else in AA. I've stayed here long enough to hear all of my story. I'm sitting here tonight because I heard Carrie at Pensipa tell my story, and I went up and talked to her, and I ended up talking to him, and all of a sudden, I can tell you, I can see all these connected dots today. And like, God, there's this huge tapestry, and I'm just a few threads in it, and I can't see the whole picture. I've never been able to see the whole picture. I just have deluded myself into thinking I know what everybody else is supposed to be doing. And when I stay in my little piece of the tapestry, it goes well. When I try and stamp away and I think I know what I'm doing, bad juju, man. Me running my life is bad news. Whether I'm drunk or sober, it's bad news. So like I said, the first time I got loaded with my Uncle Mike. We went to a local tavern, ET's, and he put $100 in the bar and said, "Kid, get the kid whatever he wants." I ordered a Jack Daniels, a Jim Beam, Tequila Sunrise, a Coors Light, a Michelob, everything I knew the name of. Now, that's the first time I got loaded. It's not the first time I drank. The first time I drank, I was 7. It was a Pabst Blue Ribbon with the old peel top can. I asked my Uncle Jim why he liked those things. He said, "Go get me two." And he peeled them, handed one, cheers me. I don't know if I got drunk. I don't know if what the effect was. I know that I didn't have to go back in the kitchen with the girls. I was allowed to hang out with my uncles. And so in my mind, I linked being a man with drinking. That's part of being a man. My dad was a career Marine. All of my family were military. I was told at a young age, if you want to cry, I'll give you something to cry about. Men don't cry. Work hard, play hard. Those are the rules. And John Wayne was a big thing in my family, you know. Grew up on those movies, grew up on that idea, and that almost killed me. Because it made me really, really reluctant to ask for help or let you see me to believe what I perceived to be weak. And so I started drinking that first night, and I don't know what drinking does for you guys. I can tell you exactly what it does for me. You give me a few drinks, pressure's off. My sponsor describes it, my current sponsor, as the spring loosens. And, I become funnier. I become taller. I can talk to the girls. I'm not as worried or afraid. I'm not much. The pain starts to dull. And if I could stay in that place, 3 to 7 drinks, A, I wouldn't qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'd still be there. But I overshoot the mark every single time. And that's my truth. And 6 months into my drinking, and I don't remember whether it was the first day or the first week, but I remember really having this thought that I love this. I'm going to be doing this a lot. And if you've ever seen Texas Hold'em, it's like my life was the chips, and I just went, I'm in. And I didn't start and stop. I'm not one of these people that drank in the woods. I didn't drink as a kid. I watched what it did my family. I'm the oldest male in my family. I watched diabetes and alcoholism. They don't mix. I watched my uncles lose their sight, lose their limbs. I remember my Uncle Jim being in an oxygen tent trying to get his ex-wife to go out and get him a six-pack and a pack of Marlboro. That's all he wanted. Dying. with a six-pack and a Mac and Marlboro. And I'm smarter than that. I'm never going to be like them. And then I met this thing. And if I had known the effect it gave me, I would have started drinking as soon as I could. Five. But I didn't know what it could do for me. I just watched what it did to other people. And I love the effect produced by alcohol. I absolutely love it. And if Alcoholics Anonymous didn't offer me the similar effect or a better effect, I wouldn't be here. So I was all in, and I got into the restaurant business, not because I like to cook, because I like to drink. And it's okay to drink on the job. It's one of the benefits. You get a shift drink. And I ended up going to culinary school because after a while, just working jobs, I needed to get a career. And I had an ex-fiance, well, current fiance at that time, who was like, you need to get a career. So I went to school. And in culinary school, they have a class called wines. And wine class for me was on Thursdays at 9 a.m. in West Philly. I went to the restaurant school. And 9:15, I'm getting another little sip because I need to taste more. 9:30, I need a little bit more. Now I'm kind of behind the proctor's back, and by 10 o'clock, we're going out for our first cigarette break, and I disappear. I go to Wizards or Cavanaugh's, or because I'm drinking now. And when I'm drinking, I'm drinking. Everything else just kind of goes to the side. And if I can drink and do the activity, I'll do it. But if I can't drink and do the activity, I'm probably not doing the activity. Just that's the way it is. And so I advanced in this career, and not because I'm good. I'm a pretty good kitchen monkey. I'm not really an executive chef. I've had that title a few times, mostly through lies and manipulation or attrition. I stayed and everybody else left. And I advanced in this career, and within the first couple of years, and I'll say this once in respect to Alcoholics Anonymous traditions, I did a lot of non-conference approved dry goods. And the things that I did allowed me to drink for 2, 3, and 4 days straight with no sleep. I love those things too. I went to another fellowship and still go to that fellowship to talk about those things when I feel the need to. I believe identification is very important. I don't lie to myself about what I am and who I am. So I call myself a triple fed. AANA and Al-Anon, if you didn't catch that. If you stay here long enough, you usually end up in Al-Anon. My experience. So I'm drinking, and that fiance, we're 2 years into it, and I remember thinking, like, I better put a ring. That like I don't want to be that guy, so I start like hinting around about a ring, and she starts going to like diamond seminars with her mom and tells me exactly what she wants, and I botched that really bad, and I didn't show up with her ring, I showed up with something I thought was cool. It's kind of what I do. I'm really good at the 50-yard dash and 100-yard race. And we kept breaking up and getting back together and breaking up, and we were broken up at one point, and she called me and she said, I came home and found her brother had killed himself. He had put a shotgun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. And she found him. And she said, Tony, I need you. I need you to be here. And if I can rely on you, if I can lean on you, then I can go through this. My family loves you. They need you too. And I love that woman. Her name was Bridget. And I told her I will be there. I absolutely will be there. I will let you lean on me. And one of the best compliments I've ever been paid was by her mother. We were at breakfast one day, and her mother says to me, I love my children, Tony, but I like you so much more. They treated her horribly. They yelled at her. I would never yell at, like, I don't know. Anyway, so the viewing was on a Monday, and this call came in on a Thursday, and I drank the whole weekend because there was this image in my head of me being in that casket because I drank like him. I drank with him a few times, and I didn't show up. How do you make that right? And she called me and raged at me. And I was glad. I was happy that she was that angry. Because now I wouldn't hurt her anymore. Now she would really leave. See, I knew by then, and I was 23, I knew by then that my word didn't mean anything. I knew that if I said I was going to be there on Tuesday, I would mean to be there on Tuesday, but I might show up on Thursday. Maybe. If I remembered. Remember, this is pre-cell phone, pre-calendar. And so I kept drinking, and I'm a blackout drinker, so there's a lot of a blur in there. So I figured out what the problem was. It was Delaware County. It was Philadelphia. It was Delaware. So I moved to New Orleans, Louisiana to quit drinking. If you want to know why I'm insane, there's a good starting point. In my mind, that truly made sense. I was going to be the next Emeril Lagasse. I was going to be the next Paul Preneau. I was going to advance my career. And if you don't know anything about New Orleans, they don't have an open container law, and the bars do not close. Period. During Katrina, two bars stayed continuous operation the entire time during the hurricane. I was in a Class 3 hurricane down there. I'd lived there for a year. And I did advance in my career, and I ended up working in the same restaurant group that turned out Emeril Lagasse and Paul Preneau. They came out of Commander's Palace, and I was working at Mr. B's Bistro, which was the next step, was Commander's Palace. And I worked my way up in there. And then they gave us all 4 days to go celebrate Halloween, and I blacked out. And I showed up on the sixth day thinking it was the fourth day. And they just kind of looked at me like, where have you been? I was like, it's Tuesday. They're like, no, it's Thursday. Oh, all right. The fifth time I got robbed down there was at gunpoint, and I got out of Dodge. Like, I will swear to you to this day, the gun barrel was about that big around. It was just huge. And I'd never had a gun in my face before, and it kind of really scared me. And so I came back to Philadelphia, and within an hour of getting off the train in Philadelphia, I was drinking. Within 3 hours, I was in E.T.'s Tavern. Within 2 weeks, nothing changed. Nothing. A year later. So I did a couple more years of that. I had one job where I got fired or quit 13 times and got hired 14. And at one point, like I was like attrition, they kept bringing me back because I kept showing up and they would pay me in cash every day. And I cooked in some high-class places too. I cooked at the Radnor Hotel, a couple places. But I figured it out. And by now, the other things were really becoming a problem because they're lasting days and days, and I'm not showing up for anything, and I'm disappearing, like, off the planet for days at a time. And coming out, and I feel like a human cockroach because I'm avoiding sunlight, and I can't stand the touch of people, and I just can't. So it was access. The problem is access. If I don't have access, I'll be all right. So I moved to an island in Maine. There was only one bar there, and I worked there, so I couldn't drink there. Within 24 hours, I was drunk on a lobster boat. I saw a case on a guy's boat. I said, he said, yeah, buying, flying, yeah, go. Within a week, the cabin I was staying in had a fully stocked bar, including triple sec. I have no idea why I bought triple sec, because it doesn't have much alcohol content, but I've bartended, and I know that bars have triple sec, so I bought triple sec. That summer, I was drinking White Russians. The theory being that cream is heavier than alcohol and it'll coat my stomach, and maybe I'll get an hour before I black out of actual fun. And that made complete and utter sense to me. Like, Jim, glass of whiskey, Jim. I love Jim. I get Jim. I also kind of wanted to be the Big Lebowski, the dude, you know, that was kind of the thing. And the restaurant I was cooking at, the only way you got to it was by yacht. I cooked for Stephen King. I cooked for Martha Stewart. I cooked for Ted Kennedy. I cooked for a bunch of people that millionaires. And the owner of the place, when he had hired me, said, I don't really care what you do. It's a tax write-off for me. As long as the food's good, my friends are happy, do whatever you want. I ordered wasabi plants from Japan and live orchids from South America, and I had duck flown in, and my ego was the size of Detroit. It was insane. And in a blackout, I said some really unsavory things to his son. And because there was ladies present, I won't repeat them. And they pulled me into the office the next day and they said, "Tony, we like you. You're a good chef. What's wrong with you?" And I told them all the things I told you guys. I'm an only child. I'm an orphan. I have ADD. I have ADHD. I have PTSD. I have a lot of things with initials that they've given me over the years. And I don't know if they're true or not. I buy some of them. You don't come out of the places I came out of without some scars. Those things, they are the truth. But they're used by me. See, they're my trump cards. I use them to manipulate people. I'll tell you about this so I can get this emotional reaction from you. I'm looking for compassion. I'll settle for pity. But really, I just want to get out of jail for free. I really don't want to be held accountable for my actions. And they listen, and they go, "Well, that's really nice. Here's $5,000, get off our island." I said, "Okay." And I took their $5,000, and I walked out on the beach. Maine, not palm trees, rocky shore. There's a lighthouse down the coast. And I looked up at the sky, and I said, "If you're even there, please help me. I don't know what to do anymore. I just don't know what to do anymore." And I believe today that my ego came crashing down that day, because that was the last thing I had, man, was my job. There was no more girlfriends. There was no more property. There was no more car. There was no more anything. But I went to work every day. And as long as you go to work, work hard, play hard. And they took that from me. And my ego crashed. And I came back to Philadelphia. And I went on a 3-week run in the Pascal Projects in Southwest Philly, with the intent purpose of dying. And I don't say that lightly. I have 11 suicide attempts in my history. 7 of them are, "Hey, somebody pay attention to me." But 4 of them are, "Please stop the planet. I want to get off. I just can't." And I spent these 3 weeks in about $3,500, and I didn't die. And when you can't live and you can't die, it's a hell of a place. It's a great place to start recovery. I called up a number that a woman had given me in her office, and the way she phrased it to me was, "If you ever think you have a problem, here's the number to call." And I called that number and I said, "When's your next thing?" And they said, "It's 8:30. I said, "I'll be there." And I went in and I met a guy. "My name's Bob. There's coffee in the bag." "All right, whatever, dude." Next guy, "Hey, I'm Bob. There's coffee." "Whatever." And I sat next back corner near the back door, so if I didn't like what went down, I was out. And the next guy sat next to me, his name was Frank, and he talked to me about booze and what he liked to drink. And he 12-stepped me out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that was what was happening. Then he started talking about God, and I just went, done with that. I knew who God was. He hated me. Look at my history. He hated me. I used to have a t-shirt that said, "Heaven doesn't want me, and hell's afraid I'm going to take over." And I truly believe that. Ego problem. And then I proceeded to come to meetings. I've never been to treatment as a client. And people would say things to me, and this is my one problem with Alcoholics Anonymous. People would say things to me like, "Get a sponsor. Don't drink between meetings. Get a home group. Don't judge anybody, but stick with the winners. Acceptance is key to all your problems, but you need to learn how to let it go. If you don't remember your last load, you haven't had it yet." If you've ever said that to somebody, please stop. It kills people. "I black out when I drink. I don't ever remember it. I went out on a 2-day run trying to make it memorable. I could have died." So if you say that to people, be really aware that that's not in our literature. None of our literature. Off my soapbox. Sorry. Every time I speak, though. So I started going to meetings, and I went to meetings drunk. I drank in a meeting. Rum goes okay in coffee, by the way. And I just couldn't get traction. And at 88 days, I figured out that the drinking and the meetings, they don't really mix real well. And I had to make a decision. And I heard this guy's story, and he was my age, and he had been to boarding school, and he was an Irish Catholic. And I said, if he's sober, I could be sober. It's possible. It's doable. So I made my mind up that I was going to give this my best shot. And that was November the 6th, 2000. And I've been sober ever since. I got sober, and they told me I would feel better if I got sober. They were correct. I felt anger better, and fear better, and shame better, and guilt better, and I started crying at dog food commercials. Guns N' Roses freaked me out for a while. They were deep lyrics, I don't know what to tell you. And I'm externally getting better. I'm going to work on a regular basis. I'm showering on a regular basis. I'm wearing clean clothes. I've got a girlfriend. I got stuff. Buy a new bed. Hadn't had one of them in 20 years. And internally, I'm going ballistic. My mind's racing uncontrollably. I'm angry all the time. I just can't quite get it going. And at 8 months sober, I'm sitting at a trolley stop looking at Tommy's gun shop thinking, how can I get a gun to blow my head off? Because I can't live this way. And I'm 8 months sober. What's the problem? It's not alcohol. Not alcohol. Alcoholism. Untreated. And didn't know there was a solution to that. When I got sober, it seemed to me that the big impetus in meetings was get in service, get a sponsor, and get a home group. I did all those things. And my first sponsor asked me, where are you at with God? I said, I don't believe in him and I hate him. He pointed out to me the insanity of that statement. Either you believe in him and you hate him, or you don't believe in him and you can't believe in something you don't hate. You can't hate something you don't believe in. I said, fine, I hate him. He said, good, tell him. I said, what? He said, you have a relationship. It's a really bad relationship, but you have a relationship. Tell him. So my first prayers for months, probably 2 years, included a lot of four-letter words. But there was a channel. Trickle, but a channel. And at 8 months, I wanted to kill myself, and I came back to him, and I said, I think I need to do these step things. He said, okay, let's do them. And I love my first sponsor. I want to be really clear. He was the best man at my wedding. If I could have saved his life by giving him blood or marrow, I would have. But he wasn't a step guy. He was a step book meeting guy. He was a God-centered, humble man. And he taught me a lot about what a man looks like and how to go through adversity with God in the center of it. But he kind of just didn't give me much direction. And we said our third step prayer at a clubhouse, kneeling, holding hands. I felt really odd. I didn't have any effect from it. I thought it was the precursor so I could write inventory. And I hemmed and hawed on writing inventory. And I know exactly how long it takes to inventory. 6 hours plus however long you choose to procrastinate. In my case, that was 7 months. And at that 7 months, I started watching the people I got sober with drink again. And I went to him and I said, when is my turn to relapse? The way people have framed it, it sounded like a good idea. You get to go to this rehab place, right? And it's 30 days where you don't have to deal with your bills and you don't have to deal with people and they feed you and they clothe you and you can get a girlfriend, apparently, and you can smoke and Club Med. I'm working two full-time jobs to try and keep a roof over my head. And he said, you don't get a turn. Somebody has to stay. So that when they come back, there's somebody here. I said, oh. So I was at South Philly Group, and this guy said, if you don't do a fourth, you pick up a fifth. And I heard it loud and clear. So I made an appointment to do my fifth step with him, and I hadn't finished my fourth step, but I figured I'd put myself under the gun. Like, I really work great under pressure. I don't, but I think I do. And I half wrote a bunch of stuff, and I specifically did not write some stuff that was never going to be talked about ever out loud to another human being, because nobody needs to know that. Like, I was molested as a child. You want my fourth step? It's in my car. I'll give it to you. I don't care anymore. I'm not free. I'll tell you any of it. It doesn't really matter anymore. And it might benefit you if you've had some more experiences. So we go out to this park, and I start reading this stuff. And after a little while, I just put that aside, and I start talking. And I felt like I was throwing up, but it was emotional. And if you've ever thrown up, and I assume everybody here has at least once, you can't really stop it in the middle. It just kind of has to go and run its course. And so I'm telling him these things, and then I'm telling more things, and it's like, I can't stop. And I'm like, you're saying, why would you say that out loud? What are you doing? Don't do that. And at the end of it, I had exactly what the book describes. I look the world in my eye, nearness to my creator, peace and ease. On the car ride back, I turned to him. I said, Mark, if you ever drink again, I have to kill you. I absolutely meant that. Like, that was not a joke. I was not okay with somebody knowing what they knew about me and drinking again. I should probably paint you a picture of what I looked like at that time. I had blue hair. I had 31 piercings in my face. I'd been carrying a blade since I was 8. I didn't stop that until I was 2 years sober. I wore fight rings or motorcycle chain as a wallet chain. I was not fit for human consumption is how I like to think of it. And then I would sit there and wonder why he didn't invite me out for coffee after the meeting.
Stay away from me.
But they don't want to hang out with me. That facade was built up over years because I was so lost and so dark inside that I couldn't even do chit-chat anymore. And I just figured if I kept you away, you couldn't reject me. So just, I was so lost when I came here. So lost. And, took a while for that to melt. There used to be a guy, his name is Jack, and Jack was an orphan child too, and he was about 5'7", 120 pounds. And he used to get in my face, you're not as scary as you think you are, come here. And he was a biker, and he was a little tough cookie, and he knew me and understood me on a level that most men can't. He used to take me out we'd go out for coffee and I'd end up eating because I was hungry and he would feed me and I would tell him I didn't order that and he'd be like, you don't get to choose how I do 12-step work. He'd see me shorten a cigarette and I hate shorting a cigarette. I don't smoke anymore cigarettes and I don't like the way it tastes when you light it back up, but if I was low, I would short them and he'd go out to his truck and grab a pack of Marlboro and wing it at my head. You don't get to choose how I do 12-step work. So I did this fourth and fifth step, and I had this amazing experience, but I was fixed. I felt awesome. That night, I got a girlfriend. And there was no problem. She had exactly as much time as I did within a week. She was in NA. It's okay. I didn't have to see her. Perfect, right? Can't go to that meeting again. And the next year and a half, I wreaked havoc in people's lives with untreated alcoholism. And I crossed moral lines that I didn't even cross drinking. I willfully slept with a married woman who I know her husband and her children. Sober. 2.5 years. Because I was still gone inside. I had identified all this stuff, but I was not willing to let it go. See, these are my survival traits. This is what I need to keep me from you. And I had this idea that if I could just get the right credit rating and I get the right girlfriend and get the right apartment, that God would love me. See, he was good for you guys, but he wasn't good for me because he hated me. He hated me. And I understand today that he loved me so much that he let me walk through all that. He walked side by side, and sometimes he carried me. And so there was this guy, and Tommy. And Tommy had come around 6 months before I did. And I watched Tommy come in, and he was more shot out than I was. And that's saying something. And I watched him get better. And his sponsor, Dave, would sit down with him with this book. I didn't like Dave. at all. Dave and I are very similar. I actually saw Dave the other day, and he's just coming back. I got to welcome him. I said, Tommy, can you do whatever Dave does with you, with me? He said, sure. And he came to my little apartment off Long Lane in Upper Darby. If you're familiar with the area, that's kind of Shadyville. And we'd park in front of my apartment and come up every Tuesday night, and we'd read this book. And we did exactly what it said, page for page, line for line, word for word. It said, pray, we prayed. It said, write, we wrote. Whatever it said to do, we did. And I started to see some truth. And I had an amazing, amazing experience around it. And from that day to this day, I can tell you the thought of drinking has never come back. It's one of the reasons I introduce myself the way I do. Killing myself has come back, but not drinking. The thought of drinking has never come back. I believe that promise has been removed. As of today, I can't account for tomorrow. So, at the same time that that was going on, I seceded from AA. Nobody noticed. I just couldn't stand the meetings anymore, at least the ones I was going through, people talking about their dead cats and their weed whackers and the drama. So I stopped going to meetings. And somewhere along the line, I'd heard this guy's talk somewhere in a car somewhere. Don't give a nerd a computer. By the way, I'm a nerd. I'm not cool. I'm a nerd. It's what I am. And I'm okay with who and what I am today. And so I got online and I started searching out different things, and I found XA speakers. And I listened to that guy's talk, and I listened to that guy's sponsor's talk, and I listened to that guy's sponsor's talk. And eventually I was listening to Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. And I was listening to Clarence Snyder and Sister Ignatia. There's a talk by Eddie on there. I listened to the people that started this thing. And the message that they were sharing was vastly different than what I was hearing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Then I found Joe and Charlie. And then I found Mark Houston and Joe Hawk. And they kind of broke the book down in a way I'd never heard. And I got a lot of information. And I came back to AA with this book under my arm. And I walked into meetings. And I got up in guys with 30 years' faces and told them, you're doing it wrong, you're killing people. Arrogant. Best of intentions, but arrogant. Sniper sharing from the back. Well, the book says. No lot real experience with it, but a lot of knowledge. The one thing I will tell you that I've continuously done right, I believe right, if whatever, that's a relative term, but I've continuously sponsored Ben since I was 8 months sober. The first guy that asked me to sponsor him, I thought to myself, you want what I have? You're out of your effing mind. I don't want what I have. And for that hour or two or three that I cared about him more than I cared about me, it was magic. Magic. And I got used to chapter 7 in this book. My sponsor had me read it over and over and over again. It's one of the highlights of my week, day, hour. Is working with somebody else, and it's not always a newcomer. Recently, I've been attracting people with double-digit sobriety. I don't know why. It's not my knowledge they want. So, with the best of intentions, I come back into AA, and I get busy, and I home group, and all this other stuff, and I meet my ex-wife, and we become the AA joke. I met her when she had 6 days. I didn't get with her in 6 days, in my own defense. At 10 months, she texted me, are you ever going to try and kiss me? You know we're dating, right? I didn't, but I did. 3 months later, we were living together. 6 months after that, we were engaged. And a year after that, we were married. And 2 years after that, we were divorced. And the day our divorce was final, she got engaged to her current husband. And, a lot of hurt behind that. In that time frame, I had a fire and lost everything I owned. I buried all of my uncles. I went and got a whole ton of really cool tattoos. I have my entire leg is a lighthouse, and there's double reasons for that. But the lighthouse at the beach, and there's another reason. Because I believe in AA, that's what we're supposed to be. I believe we're supposed to be lighthouses. I believe that there's a lot of darkness out in that world right now, and if we shine bright enough, they can find us when they need us. And not just AA, not just in this room, but out there in the world. I'm not a tugboat. I don't go out and find them. I just try and shine. And when people need help, I want to be there. So, when that time frame, I went back to school and I graduated from school, which was a new thing. I'm really good at the 50-yard dash and 100-yard race. And I graduated and I got a different career. And in a matter of, I graduated in September. I got fired from my job in October. We hit the rocks in November. By December, we were separated. And by January, I had a new career. And what did I do? What I always do. I went to work. A lot. 40, then 50, then 60 hours. I was obsessively checking my email at 3 in the morning. I was trying to stay ahead of the curve because I had to be better than everybody else around me. Because here's the first time that I walk in a room, I'm not the smartest guy in the room, and I know it. I'm looking around going, Penn graduate, Villanova, Drexel, alcoholic. What the hell am I doing here? Got very overwhelmed. And my alcoholism started to tickle the back of my head. Didn't come as a drink. It came as work, money, power, a title. I needed to get a title. I got promoted 14 months into that job above people that had been there for 10 years. I'm really good at the 50-yard dash and 100-yard race. And in 2 years, I had vice presidents calling me to solve their problems. I had people IMing me all the time. And that's where the line comes from. My last name is Sharer. It's Harris backwards because my company had 110,000 employees. And I would tell them, that's how you find me in global. I'm the only one. And my ego got big again. How do you become famous in an anonymous program? And humility is a key ingredient. At 14 years sober, I started having depressive episodes. I'd wake up and I just couldn't deal. And that was new. And I would just not go to work. I'm sick. And in a way I was. Just not physically. And then it got to be 2 days in a row. Then it was 3 days in a row. Then it was lucky if I went to work twice in a week. And it got worse and worse and worse. And I'm lucky. And I should tell you that my sponsor came down with cancer. And I stopped being his sponsee and started just being his friend. Because I felt like an idiot talking about my problems when he's dying. And I went around to AA and I started praying, God, please send me a teacher. I need a teacher. Please send me a teacher. And that teacher had to have 30 years. He had to work out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He had to have multiple sponsees. I set criteria on what God was supposed to send me. God, here's the menu. Here's the script. When I play God, it doesn't go well either. So I asked a bunch of these men, and every one of them rejected me in various ways. And by the fifth one, I was like, okay, screw you people. I'm 14 and a half, almost 15 years sober. I've done these steps. I've taken hundreds of people through them. I can do this. And I took myself through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, if you do that, there's no God. Because if you can create your own spiritual experience, why do you need God? And I did take myself through the steps, backwards. Didn't see it. Got sicker and sicker and sicker. God had interceded a bunch of times. It was a couple of people in my life that I was staying honest with the whole time. I was talking to them about what was really going on with me. And each one of them was saying, you need help. You need help. And I couldn't see it. I just couldn't see it. I can't see my ears. I'll never be able to see my ears. When I'm delusional, I don't know that I'm delusional. I'm delusional. And if you're sitting here in Alcoholics Anonymous for some time, I believe that time's a trap. Because your mind starts telling you things like you should know things. You should be further along. You should have what he has. You should be able to handle this now. I'm sober through God's grace, no other reason. And I go at God's pace, not even mine. And so in this time frame, I'm going to big book studies. I'm trying to latch on to something. I'm trying to catch something. And I meet this guy, Ed. Ed's my sponsor today, by the way. And I met Ed. And Ed drives a Lexus. He's from the main line. I looked at him and judged him. Yeah, no, I'm good. And my friend was like, get his number. I was like, fine. A week later, I asked him out for coffee. Those of you who don't have a sponsor, asking a man out for coffee is like asking a man to be your Valentine. But if you could do this by yourself, why are you even here? Why are you even here? Go do it. Good luck. Good luck. Book tells me to tell you that. So I called this guy, and we sat down for coffee, and we're talking, and he was coming off of a long-term breakup, and he had some more experiences, and he grew up the same way, and all of a sudden, like, ah. And here's the kicker, because I still had this interview mentality, and I said, who took you through the steps? When was the last time you went through them? And he said, well, and he had lived in L.A. for a long time. He moved to New York. Well, he's from here. He moved to New York, moved to L.A., moved back to New York, then moved back here. And he said, my sponsor was Scott R. But he wasn't the last guy that took me through the steps. It was this guy, Joe, that took me through the steps. My sponsor said, you know, I've taken you as far as I can take you. You need to go see this guy. And he does, like, big book studies. And he's in Santa Clara. His name's Joe. And I went, Santa Clara? Joe. Joe Hawk? He said, yeah. You know him? I was like, no. But he's pretty much my inspiration. He died a few years ago, and I would never have met him. But one of the guys that he took through the steps is currently sponsoring me. And we started getting busy with this work, and we started to do things, and the way he does it is very intense. A lot of writing. But I balked at that. I got to the third step, and I made the third step decision. But you see, I didn't need to do inventory because I was delusional. And I'd done that a few times, and I knew what my problems were. And I collected my 15-year coin, proceeded to tell my home group how much my life sucked, how I hated everything, how I wanted to die sometimes, and then thanked them for their time. A month later, I found myself in my very first facility. I've always loved going to psych units. I love going to psych units. They're my people, very colorful and interesting people. I identify a lot of times. I really do. And every time that they'd like lock the first set of doors and the first set hasn't opened, I'd think to myself, do you know what I really think? You'd never let me out of here. And then they always let me out of there until they didn't. My sister checked me in. She's not my blood sister, but on the paperwork there, she's my sister. Because she had to be family to do it. And I let her. And I spent 11 days in my very first facility. And I got some clarity. And I saw the truth. The truth was I was in trouble. And my sponsor, I called him the third day, and he came in and he started visiting me. And he came every night, and we started writing inventory. And we started reading inventory during visiting hours. I finished my fifth step at Panera Bread. You want to know it? I don't care anymore. It was five notebooks worth of writing, and I saw things that I had never seen before. In 15 and a half years sober, I'd never seen some of this stuff. And, so they let me out of the facility, and there was no meetings in the facility. And so the first thing I'm going to do is go to an AA meeting. So I went to an AA meeting. I'm sitting there. I'm 2 hours from not having shoelaces. And the chairperson doesn't show up. And my friend Angie's like, oh, chair, you speak. I'm like, awesome. Sure. And I told them my current experience. I told them what an abbreviated version of what I told you guys. And a woman in that meeting shared that she thanked me for being that honest. Because of 22 years, she had made her first facility. And she was ashamed of it. I'm not ashamed of it. I needed help. Looks quite clear. We seek help when we need it. We make use of what these people have to offer. And the next year, I spoke everywhere. Without exaggeration, I spoke 100 times in a year. I didn't want to do that. I still don't want to do this. See, for me, I believe to be effective at this, I need to be vulnerable and honest. And I don't know. I know two people. I know John, well, two and a half. I know Brian, I know John, and the gentleman that asked me. That's all I know in this room. But I have to be vulnerable in front of you. And that's counter to everything I've ever learned. But for God to shine through, there has to be a channel, which means I have to be open. It's not necessarily a pleasant thing to do this, for me, at least. And in that year, my external world kind of got crazy. I didn't work for a year. My bills got paid. My car stayed, kept running. I did a lot of side work here and there, and it just seemed like things kept working themselves out, and I just sponsored everybody. At one point, I had 13 sponsees, because I wasn't working. Sure, you want to meet? Yeah, let's go. That's all I was doing. And God was taking care of the rest. Stick close to Him and perform His work well. He'll take care of all of your needs. That's my experience. That's how it played out for me. And I ended up moving in with another guy in the program, and eventually, like, I had a 401k that I cashed in, and I had some money, but not nearly enough to live on. And there were times it was like car insurance, eating. I definitely need to eat. I just won't drive for a couple of days. And I got this job, and I work at a school now, and I'll try and bring this into a current experience. I was told very early on, if you want to hear the voice of God, it's in the laughter of children. So at like a couple months sober, I used to go to this park, and I used to bring my book, and I'd listen to little kids play. And you know, at like 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, there's no judgment. They'll play with anybody. They worry about nap, snack, who has the ball. That's it. I don't want to grow up. I want to grow down. I really do. And so I got this job, and I'm walking down the hall in my third week, and the kindergarten gets out, and they're all running around, and the backpacks are as big as they are, and I hear it. And I well up, and I duck into the teacher's lounge, and there's a couple teachers in there, so I duck in the bathroom in the teacher's lounge, and I get on my knees, and I thank God. I thank God for His voice and His guidance and showing up in my life on so many occasions. I could tell you hours of God stories. And I'll just tell you two last ones. I struggled with a spiritual belief system that would fit me, and I tried a whole bunch of them on. I believe the 11 steps to playground. You get to go play and find out what works for you. And I found a book called Dharma Punks that kind of made sense to me, and I found some other books, and I found some other people, and I started sitting with different people, and I consider myself a practicing Buddhist. And I do that irrespective of AA. I don't mix the two. Just where I find peace, because the book I read says God will find deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And the last analysis is there that He can be found. If I can get quiet enough, I can access that. And I have. I can't keep it. Minute here, 2 minutes there, and then this gets loud again, and I follow the bouncing ball, and all of a sudden how they get there. But 2 minutes is more than I ever had growing up. So, really cool thing that my school does, one of the schools I work at, is they teach third graders how to write thank you notes. I think that's a really cool thing to learn in third grade. And so all these little kids are running around giving thank you notes to random staff members, and one of them comes up and says, Mr. Paul. My full name is Paul Anthony Sharrett, so they call me Mr. Paul. This is for you. I didn't even know her as a can of paint. And I just well up and thank you so much. That just moved my day, and she walked out, and I had to shut my door, and I bawled, and I felt it, and the kindness of others, with no expectation of anything in return. Isn't that what we do here? Isn't that what we're supposed to do here? And she's a better example of it than some people I know in AA with 20 years, and she's 6 or 7, I don't know, whatever you are in third grade. So I get teachers that are yay high. It's awesome. In my belief system, see, most of the time I hear what people say. Once in a while, I truly feel what they say. It resonates with me in this deep place, this soft belly place. And in my belief system, there's a word for that. May the spirit inside of me honor the spirit inside of you. So thank you, and namaste. Thank you.